But basically, I thought I was, I thought there was some representation going on for me on a particular building where my attorney wasn't representing me, wasn't showing up in court, wasn't doing anything that needed to be done here. And the litigation had turned ugly. I didn't know anything about it. And basically, the plaintiff walked in and ended up getting a $5.6 million personal judgment against me on a non-recourse loan, which is a story for another day. But I'm sitting here absolutely clueless until I'm trying to send a wire out from a business, just an endeavor that I had taken on, and the wire got returned. And I had to ask them, you know, what was going on there. And they said, I can't help you, but call this number. And sure as shit, they had been able to get a $5+ million judgment against me in Illinois on this case, and got it enforced against me here in California, where within a matter of 24 hours, they were able to literally seize all of my assets and put everything into lockdown, including freezing all of my bank accounts. And that took the better part of 20 months to get resolved. But I basically, for the better part of 20 months, had to figure out how to live off of almost nothing.
Thanks for joining me. This episode of Legends and Losers is sponsored by Oracle NetSuite. To turbocharge your growth, check out netsuite.com/legends. This episode sits right at the heart of our mission to hack what it takes to design a legendary business and a legendary life, and how to overcome a meaningful amount of failure and losery along the way. Our guest is none other than legendary entrepreneur, New York Times bestselling author, and host of two super popular podcasts, Reinvention Radio and Beyond Eight Figures, Steve Olscher. He tells, we have an epic, real, raw conversation where he shares no BS stories about success and failure. We talk about what it is to find your what. His book is called What Is Your What? And he tells us what it's like to be married to a funeral director.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right. The Ramones said, hey ho, let's go. And Robert Earl Keane said, the road goes on forever and the party never ends. So glad you joined me for this episode of Legends and Losers with the incredible entrepreneur Steve Olscher. For more on his background, go to legendsandlosers.com. You can check out the show notes. You can get his contact information, information about his podcast, his book, and all the other cool stuff he's up to. And now, here he is, the amazing Steve Olscher.
We got completely blinded by the dot-com light. And bought into Wall Street's take on it, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, we had brought in Wall Street to help take us public, and they told us we needed all the lettered saviors, you know, the CMOs, the CEOs, CTOs, the WTFs, you know, I mean, all those guys. And we signed away management rights, man. And March of 2000 hit, and it was very clear when we couldn't get out that these guys had no clue what they were doing. And I walked away from everything, including the domain, after 9 years of building up that company. But
wow.
Yeah, it was an interesting, scary piece of my life that and you talk about the numbers behind the domain and what that might actually be worth today. Well, I can tell you what it's generally worth, because in 2006 I was actually able to reclaim the domain. Now, mind you, I never signed away my rights to the domain when I had bought it. But when it went with the company and the company ended up tanking, somehow it ended up just getting, you know, just getting buried in all of that. And I, like I said, I literally walked away from everything, including the domain, and ended up tracking it down to a guy in the country of Panama in late 2005. And it was one of those moments where I'm out walking the dog and kind of out of sight, out of mind for for years. And I got into real estate development at that point and ended up building a pretty significant portfolio of about $50 million in product. But literally out of sight, out of mind, I was walking the dog one morning and the headline of the Wall Street Journal basically read something to the extent of domain name prices approaching pre-bubble valuations, you know, something like that. And I was like, Jesus, whatever happened to that liquor.com domain? And as I said, I never signed away my rights to it. But after a few months of investigating, I found it, tracked it down to this guy in the country of Panama. A few more months of chit-chatting around and, you know, never really threatened litigation, but just kind of asked the question of, you know, how did you get it? Because I knew I hadn't signed away my rights to it. And one day, I think it was Christmas Eve of 2006, actually, I get an email from the guy saying, basically, hey, I'd like to give you back your domain. I was like...
And he just gave it to you?
So I was like, okay, tell me what you want me to do. And now at this point, we had bought that domain, but I had never been like an active domain buyer or flipper or anything of that nature. So I didn't even know how to accept his Christmas gift of giving me back the domain. And he's like, look, go here, open up an account, you know, send me your login info and all this, that, and the other.
And all of your banking information.
Right.
My Nigerian prince friend.
And I'll give you back the domain. And I was just like, all right. I mean, again, I was thinking about it, like, what's the worst case here? Like, he's got my username and password for an account that's got nothing else attached to it. So I was like, all right, fine, whatever, dude. So I gave it to him. Sure as shit about, you know, 30 minutes later, he sends me an email and he goes, okay, the domain is in your account. Well, I logged in, checked, and sure as hell, the domain was in the account. I was like, holy fuck. So I changed it to password in like, you know, 2.2 seconds. And sure enough, I ended up getting the domain back after losing it for about 6 years. And subsequently put it up for sale, got a lot of offers on it. And the highest offer was $4.25 million.
Wow.
Just for the domain.
And did you take that offer?
I took that offer. The guy made the first few payments and bailed on the rest. So I kept the money.
I need to laugh at your pain.
Yeah. So I kept the money and I kept the domain. And it was like a Blues Brothers moment. It was like, okay, this is a sign from God, you know, like now I've got the seed capital. Let me go out and try to actually do something with this. And I was based in Chicago at the time. And even though I had been online for a long time, I kind of felt like, you know, the dot-com world is still a Silicon Valley phenomenon. And I ended up going out to TechCrunch and was an exhibitor in one of their first demo pits way back when at TechCrunch 40, I think is what it was called at that point. And we ended up finding some folks who offered to build the business if I contributed the domain. And we did a 50-50 on that. And we've been partners since basically 2009.
It's just one of those poetic stories. It really, sometimes entrepreneurship is like a Hollywood movie.
It can be, right? You know, the happy ending on this one isn't written yet because, I mean, the company's still alive and well. We've got a solid team that's running it out of San Francisco. I'm based in San Diego, so I've actually got no day-to-day with it, just involved on a board level. But yeah, they're running it. I mean, we get millions of uniques to the site every month. We got millions of people on the database, and we work with all the biggest brands in the world. And next step is monetization. I mean, we're doing some good things on that front, but there's a lot of room for growth.
Yeah. How fun. And it must be great because you get to be involved at a high level, but as you say, you're not having to sweat all the details. You can focus on some of the other areas of your life.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a blessing and a curse. You know, reality is I haven't always seen eye to eye. As a matter of fact, not even ear to nose or eye to mouth or whatever. I mean, we just don't even see the same page. In a lot of respects, and you know, frankly, it's been a bit of an effort and futility to try to get that group to do some of the things that I've been wanting to do over the years. And frankly, I've kind of been ostracized by the board.
I see. So, not all is hunky-dory in liquor paradise.
Well, you know, look, I mean, I don't want to sit here and disparage anybody. And again, they're working real hard over there and they got a lot of really good things going. But, you know, frankly, you know, as well as anybody, man, that when you go to a site, especially a new site that, you know, you haven't been to before and you don't plan on going back to it anytime soon, unless there's something specific you need. And you got one shot when somebody comes to your site to get them into your world, bounce them into your ecosystem, get them to spend a dollar with you. And we haven't been asking for jack shit in terms of money for the better part of, almost 9 years now.
Wow.
So
that's a lot of free content.
It's a lot of free content, you know, and that media model only takes you so far. The valuations on media are pretty piss poor. So we'll see what the exit ends up being, if and when there is an exit. But you know, there's definitely frustration there because we've got a captive audience of liquor lovers who have said, you know, hey, we love what you guys are all about. And we haven't put anything in front of them to say, hey, maybe you should buy this.
That's interesting. So it's all content. Is there any commerce now?
Negative. Nada.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So needless to say, I've been kicking around some ideas around how to, you know, potentially get more involved. But at the same token, I'm one of those schizopreneurs, man. I just like, you know, I love the freedoms that I have. I mean, my boys are 14 and 11. I take them to school every day. You know, I coach all the teams that they want me to coach. I go on the field trips they ask me to go on. And, you know, they come home and here I am. And I just have to chuckle. I mean, my 11-year-old asked me for the umpteenth time the other day. He's like, so, Dad, what is it exactly you do for work?
I talk to people.
Yeah, I talk to people. So there's that dance, man. You know, there's that balance of wanting to do it, but not really wanting to do it, you know? And there's a big part of me that knows that this is a nine-figure exit all day long, but I'd have to dig into it pretty hard for a few years. And do I want to do that in this moment of my life? And I don't know. I keep coming back to the fact that if I really wanted to do it, I'd be doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I mean this in a positive way because it's how I am. But kick me under the table if you disagree. You seem a little bit like me in the context of you're an ADHD guy. Like you got a lot of shit going on, right?
I'll put it to
this. To keep you got a lot of interests. Let me say it that way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my thing is I've often said to folks who just say that they don't have enough time and, you know, can't see how to, because part of my work is helping people really get crystal clear on what puts fire in their soul and how they're naturally wired to excel and then how to share and monetize that. And so I often hear from folks that, you know, they just don't have enough time to do X, Y, or Z. And what I always tell them is, you know, you got to stop playing with that little Elmo saucer you've been dancing with and get yourself a bigger plate because there are a lot of hours in the day. And, you know, reality is I look like I do a lot, but I implement with, as I call it, strategic abandon, which is just getting a lot of stuff done in a very time efficient and cost effective manner. And whether it's real estate or books or the podcast or, you know, speaking or doing live events or whatever it might be, it looks like I'm doing a heck of a lot more than I actually am. So the bottom line is, believe it or not, I actually got more room on this platter.
You know, it's funny that you say that because people say to me all the time, oh, I know how busy you are. And I think there's an impression that I'm really busy. And I go through times where I'm really busy.
Yep.
But I'm actually profoundly not that busy. and I'm also... I learned this. I guess I sort of always knew it, but I've been living it now for a few years. You know, I used to work like crazy 60 to 80 hour weeks, and I used to travel, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles, like just that crazy executive public company life. And so I had to train myself to be as effective as I possibly could. I can remember when I read Peter Drucker, Effective Executive, and all that. But as I stepped out of that world, it has become obvious how truly profoundly lazy I am.
But it's laziness by, and here's the reality though, it's laziness by a choice, which in and of itself means that you're not inherently lazy. It means that you've worked hard enough at some point in your life to give you the luxury of being able to choose how to invest your time. So
that's a very nice way of saying how lazy I am. But the other interesting thing is, like, if you've learned anything along the way, You've learned how to be on a team and how to assemble a great team. And it sounds so fucking cliche, but it's the only way it works. I have an amazing group of people around me, and that's how it works. And so there's a lot that comes out, and not as much going in as you would expect for how much is going out. Let me say it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's what she said, right? But no, it's, but sorry.
That's probably terrible.
but reality is, you know, look, I think that part of the reason, as I've been working with people now for the better part of 25 plus years as an entrepreneur, starting my own businesses, and then as a coaching consultant, helping others with theirs, what I've been really clear on now for the last couple of years is that most people are just trying to do way too many things. And I finally sat down and realized that, you know, forget about the real estate holdings that I have, forget about liquor.com, just in terms of this sort of Steve Ulsher personal brand of writing and speaking and having the podcast and doing live events and whatnot, you know, I've become really clear that for our seven-figure business, I'm really only doing seven things. And so the thing is that most folks try to do way too many things, which is why they feel scrambled, why their brains are just so messed up and feeling like they're just literally always chasing their tail as they're trying to pursue these goals that are neither tangible, achievable, or believable. And at the end of the day, that of the seven things that I'm actually doing, I'm really only doing one or two of those on an active basis. The other, I've set it and forget it, and they're all really evergreen. Yes, it takes work to get it. For instance, like a webinar is one of those seven things. Yes, it took a while to get to that stage where I know that the webinar converts, but once you have it, you just set it and forget it. And so as an example,
I'm curious, are you like me in that the coolest part of what I do now is everything I do is a collaboration with somebody or some small team. And I collaborate with different people and or different small teams on different stuff. So on one hand, you could say, well, you know, I'm on my own. But the reality is I'm nowhere near on my own. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, what I find fascinating about what I do now is it's great for an ADHD type person because I'm doing lots of different things, lots of different projects. And each of them is a collaboration with somebody or some small group of people who I absolutely love working with. And that's what makes it fun. I get to sort of honeybee around on stuff, and everything I land on is something that I love with somebody that I love that I'm super excited about doing. And so it never really feel. I almost feel like I need a new name that you can't really call it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, I certainly can relate to most of that, but I tend to only really work with just. I have one assistant. I mean, and that's it. And she's not even full time. And so I've got the one assistant. I've got other people that I bring in just on a contract basis as needed, but I don't have my hand in a million different pots right now. So it's funny. It's like, I was just talking about, so my wife is a funeral director and embalmer, and mostly she spends time back of house.
Oh, slow down.
Yeah.
Your wife is a funeral director and embalmer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about that. What's that like?
You know, it's funny. The reality is that on one hand, you know, you can look at it and you go, geez, you know, the things that she has to do, putting people back together, making them look pretty. I mean, like it's just like, whoa. But on the other hand, you know, it's really helped me to appreciate the fact that I think we're all artists in our own right. You know, we are all artists that create some epic shit, like you said there on their table, right? I mean, it's right there, do epic shit. And so the question is, you know, just what's our artistry? And for her, her artistry really is helping people say goodbye in a way that, you know, it's just so hard. It's such a difficult period of time for anyone, right? Who loses someone that they're close to, someone that they love. And to be a part of that pivotal moment in time and give people the opportunity to say goodbye to that person in a way that is as close to they remember them to be as possible. I mean, really is, she's doing epic shit, I guess is the bottom line.
What's her name, Steve?
So my wife's name is Lena, L-E-N-A, Lena.
Lena, and I'm curious, at what, like, how does Lena decide this is what I'm going to go do?
You know, it's interesting, right? So my book is, the book I put on the New York Times list in 2013 is called What Is Your What? Discover the One Amazing Thing You Were Born to Do.
Very big book you wrote there.
It's a good book. It's definitely helped a lot of folks. But, you know, it's interesting having conversations with your wife when you're out, and you can probably appreciate this. You know, you out and you go out, you do things in the public eye. And then you come home and you're like, okay, you know, Mr. Big Shot or whatever, help me, you know, do the dishes kind of thing. Well, that's kind of how it was with her and discovering her what. She's like, look, you're helping all of these people do all of these things. At the time when I met her, she was an orthodontic assistant. Then she went to teach in the Chicago public school system. And when we had our first child, we knew that we were going to have her stay home. So by the time she hit 38, 39, she really started thinking again, like, okay, now what do I want to do now that the kids are a little bit older? It's really interesting, but this is a calling. I mean, a lot of what I say and a lot of what I preach is that, you know, your what really has chosen you. It's not that which you have chosen. I mean, you can spend a lifetime in denial. So, yes.
Forgive me for acting like a 14-year-old, but I'm going to.
Yes.
What does it say about one's wife when at 38 years old, she discovers that mortuary is her calling? What does that say? What does that mean? Help me with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, it's interesting on a couple of different levels. Number one, she had lost both of her parents when she was very young. So I think her dad died when she was 20, and then her mom died shortly after we met. Now, we've been married for almost 21 years now. So she's been dead, obviously, then for, you know, 20 plus years. So what was also interesting is that not only did she then have this connection to wanting to help those who were going through similar situations, because again, losing your parents when you're really young puts you in, unfortunately, a pretty unique group of people there. But they also live right down the street from a funeral home. And she always admired the work that she, you know, had seen them doing over the years there. And as a matter of fact, she told her cousin when she was, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years old, that she thought she might want to help people in, you know, in their passing like this as a funeral something. She didn't know what. And as we went through some of this, it just really reopened a lot of that for her. And at 40 years old, she went to mortuary school to get her mortuary science degree.
Wow. That's fucking fantastic.
You know, she started over at 40.
Glimpse into this world years ago. I was an early consultant in the early days of sales automation and then what became CRM. And so I used to speak at these conferences, and early adopters in that category would, you know, I would get to go work with them, and it was fun. So I worked with lots of different companies in lots of different industries. Anyway, long story, way longer. One of those companies was Hillenbrand Industries. And of course, one of their divisions is Batesville Casket. Mm. And so I get to spend a bunch of time with those folks in Batesville, Indiana. And what a fascinating industry. The folks I met in that business were the most salt of the earth, fun, smart, and deeply, deeply committed to the cause. Like, they truly believed, sure, they wanted to make money and that, you know, it was a business, but deeply, deeply believed in the service they were providing and the product they were providing and how they were helping funeral directors optimize their business. It was a real sense of service inside the commerce, if you will.
Yeah. And look, there are definitely a faction of folks in the industry that feel that way and still aim to serve first. And there's, unfortunately, a much larger faction of folks that have swallowed the corporate pill, you know, and it's become a very corporate industry. The number of mom and pop funeral parlors, if you will, are very few and far between now, which is why We're actually exploring.
Most of them are owned by two or three of the conglomerates, right? Is SRI, is that the name of one?
Yeah, SCI. SCI.
SCI. Yeah. And then what was the other one? What's the other big one?
SCI's got the majority of them right now, and they operate as Dignity Memorial and a few other places.
And so does she work for a conglomerate, or does she work at a local, or how does she work?
Yeah, so she actually works for SCI now. But you know, the good news is, and I know you can appreciate this based on the work that you've done over the decades here, is, you know, this is...
I don't like it the way you say that.
Only a couple of decades. You're 22. But no, man, it is definitely an industry, for lack of a better term, that is ripe for change, that is ripe for disruption, because it has become completely corporate in so many respects, where there's just far too many people doing it for the dollars and trying to move bodies through the system. And it's a shame, because this is, you know, outside of the birth of your child and getting married, I mean, you know, the death of a loved one is, certainly on the list of happenings in your life that are amongst the most important.
Yeah. And I think there's a real conversation in our world to be had about how we stick the landing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, for sure, man.
I mean, I have a dear friend. She's really an adopted sister who's a longtime head nurse in hospice, and I have friends in that world. And it is strange how we handle end of life before they get to your wife. You know,
yeah.
The amount of money we spend, all this time we spend trying to, you know, save somebody who's not savable, and you know, there's a lot of interesting things, I think, to go look at as a culture for how we want to do this. And a conversation that I think is a powerful one is, if you're going to have a conversation about how do you design a legendary life, somewhere in there, you've got to have a conversation about how do you stick the landing? Like, what's a legendary death look like?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a powerful conversation to have with somebody. And it's a particularly powerful conversation to have with somebody you love who's dying.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it is interesting that first and foremost, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, we give a lot of credence to what we do while we're here, but very few of us actually invest any real time in designing how it is that we wanna, as you said, stick a landing and get out of here, right? So I mean, it's just like, it's one of those things that just kind of sneaks up on you, and unfortunately, far too many end up in those final days without a real plan of action of what's going to happen next. But you know, look, man, to your point, I also think that working with my wife and hearing the stories, I mean, I tell you, there's two groups of people that are the hardest for her to take care of. One are the little ones. You know, the babies, the 3, 4, 5 year olds, you know, the sub-20s for sure. I mean, the little ones working on those cases, I mean, she comes home a wreck on those, right? And then the other group that she has a really, really hard time with are those that look just like her. You know, the 40-something year old woman that is laying in front of her on that table, and you know, she's got to do whatever she can to make those final moments for her loved ones, you know, as peaceful as they possibly can be. But those are the ones that hit her the hardest, because as we look at our own lives here and what's possible, just knowing that that is the incredible mystery of it all, man, is we just never know when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And you talk about living a legendary life, and you know, the flip side of that coin, you know, having those losing propositions, I just think more of us have to be willing to lose a sense of ourselves and lose our comfort, lose you know, the appreciation, if you will, that we're looking for from others, in order to really create that final epilogue, if you will, that allows people to sing our praises long after we're able to sing our own.
Yeah. And, you know, my dad, Bruce, taught me this when I was 16, how to complete with somebody. And it's one of the biggest gifts he's ever given me. My grandfather was dying, and actually my mother's father, so not his father. His father died when he was a boy. So I, of course, never met him. But my grandfather on my mother's side was dying, and I was very, very close to him. And I didn't know it. He had a really bad asthma, and he was in and out of the hospital a bunch. And so granddad being in the hospital wasn't an abnormal thing. And so he would bounce back. And you're a kid, you know, you're a teenager, you're an idiot. I was in a band, you know, you're busy. Like it just, granddad is in the hospital. That's a bummer. Then he's going to get out and things are going to go back to normal. And that's it. Cause that's how mm-hmm. it had been. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one year around Christmas, he went into the hospital and my father said, you know, if you want to, if there's anything you want to say, you should say it. And if there's anything you want to hear, you should ask him to tell you those stories. Cause, I don't know how long your grandfather's going to be around. My father was wise enough to understand there was a change that had happened. And he was that brutally clear with me about it. And, he ended up dying, shortly thereafter. And I, Steve, you know, spent a lot of time with him, as a result of my father's comments. And, it's always amazed me, and I've now been able to repeat that over and over again to sort of be paying attention, you know, because sometimes it feels like it sneaks up on you. You know, if somebody you love is in a situation where their life is potentially ending, to really pay attention to all the subtle signs. Sometimes even doctors communicate in code and stuff. And then to always try to actually be there with the person and complete with them. And say what you want to say and hear what you need to hear. And I'm always surprised. I'd be curious to your experience and to Lena's experience, how many people sort of shun people they love as they're dying because it's so upsetting.
Yeah. And I will say that, yeah, it's one of those, no one prepares you for this. I mean, you just never know how you're going to react when this happens to someone that you care so dearly about. Right. And she's experienced it all. I mean, from working on and sort of the front of house side, if you were working with families, she's experienced it from you talk about the stages of grief, you know, the people who come in just absolutely can't pick themselves up off the floor. To the people that are just so angry and cruel to those that are trying to help in these last moments of celebrating this person's life. It really just runs the gamut. And it's one of those things where I know for a fact that when you look back on your life, you'll most regret failing to act on something that, you know, truly puts fire in your soul than taking action and realizing what those weak-minded people term as failure, right? And the most powerful experiences, if you will, or ceremonies, or, you know, end of life celebrations, if you will, that she's had the privilege of being a part of, are always with those who come there with a reverence, if you will, for those that have passed, because those who have passed have really honored the calling, if you will, of their soul. And did whatever they had to do to bring that to fruition. And the difference that you see in the families and yeah. in the crowds yeah. of people who gather for those who, I mean, really have been willing to go out on that limb and be willing to put something forth for the world to judge. I mean, man, it is so fucking easy to be a critic. And it is so hard to be a creator. And I will tell you that the people who pass, having lived most of their lives as a critic, it's reflected in the people that show up.
That's fascinating. So it sounds like Lena's calling has changed you and changed her a lot.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's, and this is the entrepreneurial struggle that I have in terms of going out and, you know, I've been kicking around the idea of raising a fund, you know, to be able to fuel some of the opportunities that I know are right here, ripe on the table right now. Will they be on the table a year from now? I don't know, but I know that right here, right now, the returns could be massive. But again, I know that when you are in those final moments, you will absolutely positively regret not spending more time with those that you love. And you will absolutely positively never look back and regret not spending more time at work, period. And, you know, you've done interviews, I'm sure you've seen studies and heard interviews and whatnot, you know, with people in their final days. Like you said, you had somebody who's in hospice in that industry. And you hear it all the time with those from those in their final days. And yeah, it's definitely given both of us an acute appreciation for the limited amount of time that we truly have. And do I fuck around? You know, am I optimizing every moment of time? I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, I got all my shit together, that I'm this, you know, this class act dude.
I don't want to, you know, there's this great Robert Earl. Do you know who Robert Earl Keane is? He's kind of it's kind of country.
It's who Robert Earl Jones wanted to be, right?
I don't know. He's sort of country, folky, rocky. He's unbelievable, Robert Earl Keane, and he's got this song called "Doing Nothing." It's something that I do. And it's like, and he sings, you know, I kind of like this doing nothing.
Yeah,
right. There's a wasting one intentionally. Wasting time is a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, and it really boils down, I think, Chris, in large fashion, to understanding what it is that you want versus what it is that you actually need. And so when I'm doing this What Is Your What work with folks and really helping them to really understand how they're naturally wired to excel and then to be able to bring that to fruition and share and monetize it, the questions always come up of, you know, do I simply quit my day job, right, and just jump right into this? And reality is, I think that's silly, right? I mean, I don't think you want to cut off your nose to spite your face. And if somebody's willing to fund your transition, then by all means, let them fund it. But what I know is that oftentimes, as an example, what we want, you know, is the four bedroom house and the nice car and the two vacations a year and this, that, and the other. And our monthly nut is, you know, I don't know, $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month, whatever it is. And if we really sat down and we looked at what it is that we actually need, we may find that we'd be perfectly content just hanging tight in a two bedroom apartment for now, and, you know, taking Uber and doing whatever it is that you need to do, if temporarily, so that you take that monthly nut from $10,000 a month down to, I don't know, let's just call it $3,000 a month. Well, what happens in that process is you've now cut down your transition by 70%. So reality is you can pursue your what as what it is that you can and will be doing on a day-to-day as more and more income is derived from sharing and monetizing that. So, you know, it's kind of like a recipe mixture. I mean, as right now, 100% of your income might be derived from what it is that you don't want to be doing, and 0% is derived from what you do. As soon as that first dollar comes in, you know, that recipe mixture starts to shift. And after a while, you know, 90% of your income is from what you don't, 10% of your income is what you do, and 80, 20, 70, 30, 60, 40, et cetera. And the smaller you can get that monthly nut, the quicker you can make that transition. And so I'm bringing this up because I do think one of the biggest questions that we have to ask ourselves is, what is it that we actually need versus what is it that we believe that we want?
Yeah, the way I think about it is, what does it take to pay for the party? And of course, what you want to be able to do is live below your means. And the ultimate, of course, I mean, and you real estate guys are all about this, get your passive income to a place where your passive income pays for the party. And to your point, a lot of people don't even look at the price of the party and say, do I really need all these things at the party?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that fine decanter you have there, man, I know that's not Louis XIII, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it's a very nice thing, but yeah. And you know, the funny thing is it's ironic, but you know, when you make some money and you can afford some stuff and you go get some stuff and you know, there's some stuff that's really awesome to have. There is awesome stuff. There's no question.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think if you're somebody with an IQ and you're somebody who thinks, and I'm not taking anything away from awesome stuff, go get your awesome shit. I think that's a perfectly fine motivation, and whatever your shit is, and if you need to buy a plane, buy a plane. Or if you're like me and you're happy with a muscle car, or maybe some people just want a cat, whatever the fuck it is, I don't care. But you do get to a place where you do realize, like, it is stuff. It's just stuff.
Yeah.
Now, well, you know, I think there are things that are way more important than the stuff. Like I think, for example, where you live matters. The community you live in, the environment you live in, I think the physical structure you live in. I don't think you need to necessarily have to have whatever XYZ house, but you need to be in an environment where when you're in that environment, you go, fuck, I love being here, right? Yeah. And you need to decide what that is. And I think you need to live in a community that you love being in, that works for you. You know, yeah. Sebastian Younger taught me this, like the value of a tribe and a community.
Yeah, you're going to have people who are going to be sitting there saying, yeah, sure, Chris. I mean, you know, you've got money. Of course, it's easy for you to say that. And, you know, of course, there's the argument that a lot of people make around, yeah, you know, it's easy for you to talk about how you don't need money when you have it. And yeah, I mean, look, everyone knows, you know, you've had your entrepreneurial struggles, your ups, your downs, et cetera. I've been there as well, you know, and I can tell you that there was a point in time, actually not too long ago, less than a year ago. I mean, I can share stories to the cows come home of literally being, you know, with the bankruptcy papers in hand and like, okay, time, you know, this is the day I file. But, you know, more recently, relating to a real estate deal, I literally had my ass handed to me from the standpoint of I moved to California in 2014. I had to get out of Chicago. I mean, I was literally had a ridiculous breakdown in November of 2013, where I was ready to throw in the towel on the whole thing, man. And you know, as they ran the tests and tried to figure out exactly what was going on, it just became really clear that my you know, my serotonin and oxytocin, like all those what do they call that? Neurotransmitters, right? All the neurotransmitter levels are just like off the charts low, like to the tune of most people walk around with their neurotransmitter levels in the, you know, the mid, you know, 50, 60, 70s, 80s type numbers. You know, all of mine were literally in the single digits in large measure because I'm naturally a sun person. I'm living in Chicago with the cold and the gray and the whole nine. I had done 44 years there and had finally taken its toll.
The weather was killing you.
The weather was literally killing me. And
wow.
And so moved to San Diego and left some real estate there.
Not killing you in San Diego, is it?
Not in the least. Although my wife would move back in a heartbeat because she likes the cold and the gray. Go figure. But left some real estate behind and left it to my attorneys to kind of button some things up there. And I will make it actually short here. But basically, I thought there was some representation going on for me on a particular building where my attorney wasn't representing me, wasn't showing up in court, wasn't doing anything that needed to be done here, and the litigation had turned ugly. I didn't know anything about it, and basically, the plaintiff walked in and ended up getting a $5.6 million personal judgment against me on a non-recourse loan, which is a story for another day. But I'm sitting here absolutely clueless until I'm trying to send a wire out from a business, just an endeavor that I had taken on. And the wire got returned and I had to ask them, you know, what was going on there. And they said, I can't help you, but call this number. And sure as shit, they had been able to get a $5+ million judgment against me in Illinois on this case and got it enforced against me here in California. Where within a matter of 24 hours, they were able to literally seize all of my assets and put everything into lockdown including freezing all of my bank accounts. And that took the better part of 20 months to get resolved. But I basically, for the better part of 20 months, had to figure out how to live off of almost nothing. And you try to figure out, you know, at that moment in time, what it is that you want versus what it is that you need. Try living without having access to any money. And that'll give you a wake-up call in a heartbeat. And so, believe me, I get it. If you don't have access to money, and that's a struggle for you.
What do you do, Steve?
So, fortunately, we were able to pay a hefty fine to the company that had brought this litigation against the property, of which I was responsible for as the developer of that building. And after 20 months, was able to get the judgments finally lifted, finally released. But, you know, it was...
You bought your way out.
So to speak, I had to liquidate to buy myself out.
Yeah, sure.
Wow. So, it was.
We made up a word around here to make stuff like that feel sound better than it actually feels. We call it losery.
Losery.
Yeah, there's going to be some serious losery along the way.
Yeah. You know, man.
So that was a moment of serious losery.
That was a moment of serious losery. And
you were in your early 40s at the time?
No, this dude, we're talking like this hit in 2016.
Like, so this, 2 years ago.
This just resolved itself in November.
Wow.
Yeah. So
is that why you like to talk about reinvention so much?
It is, you know, man. You know, it's funny because like it, literally, I think in author land, you write the book that you most need. And part of why I wrote the book, What Is Your What, and started heading down this reinvention path is for those reasons of, you know, I've always tried to figure out what it is that I'm actually here to do. And I am literally the poster child for reinvention. And from nightclubs and dot-coms to real estate to writing and speaking. I mean, I think you name it. Hell, I've even sold speakers out of the back of a van. You know what I mean? I mean, like I was that guy.
Did you ever live in a van down by
the river? Fortunately, I wasn't that guy. But you know, I mean, look, I remember having my last box of macaroni and cheese in the cabinet there and literally trying to figure out what I'm going to be doing to feed myself over the next few days. Right. I mean, I've had the hills, I've had the valleys, and, you know, ultimately I think that it's why I have been drawn to this work, because I do know that so many of us get caught up in chasing these commodity oriented opportunities that we lose a true sense of self of, you know, what is that epic shit that we really can be doing. And I cannot even begin to tell you how many people come to me who are looking to make that shift from prominence to relevance, because they wake up in the morning going, damn, I got a lot of shit, but I got no soul.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Prominence to relevance. Let me say something. I could give a shit about relevance for the sake of relevance. Because most people can't name most prior presidents of the United States. Like, there's dozens of presidents most of us can't name. And so you think, okay, well, if you were the president at any moment in history, your name would live forever, right? Well, turns out, no, there's not a lot of presidents most people can name. And so on the relevant side, I just know that you might be relevant for some sliver of time, but, you know, there are very few people that are going to be relevant two or three generations from now. And so there's all this stuff about like legacy and relevance and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know. I think you can get caught up in yourself quickly, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make, Steve.
Yeah.
And so the place where my head goes to is more a simpler place, which is, am I a person that is making a difference? Am I a person that's having fun? And most importantly, and it may sound selfish to some, but I don't know any other fucking measure really. like, does the person who brushes my teeth, is that person proud of the person in the mirror? You know, and hopefully there are people around me who are also proud of me too. I mean, if you're just proud of yourself and no one else is, that there's probably something wrong with you. But I guess my point is, this talk can lead to this sort of self-aggrandizing. And, you know, sure, if you're super rich and you want to put your name on buildings or whatever, have at it. But the reality is, oh, there's a lot of presidents most people don't remember. And so it's there's no way to sort of buy yourself into the history books over any meaningful amount of time. So I just kind of just think about it in simpler terms. Am I making a difference? Am I proud of myself? Am I having a good time? Do other people think I'm a person of value?
Yeah.
And if those things are more or less true most of the time, then, you know, I'm not going to get too caught up in myself, I guess is the point.
Yeah. I mean, look, relevance obviously is a relative term, right? I mean, how we define relevance is always going to be different depending on who the person is. But I will say this, when I say relevance, what I mean by that is, you know, if you think about the people that you've encountered in your life that have had meaningful impact in terms of, you know, can you remember the person who did X, right? Like if you think about the people that you, I mean, look, we have thousands of conversations on a yearly basis. I mean, think about it in terms of over the decades, over the course of our lifetime. And we remember very, very few conversations. So, you know, reality is that relevance is, of course, going to be a relative term. One of the most relevant conversations that I had was with actually a golf teacher of mine, someone who I had been working with in my late teens when I was 18, 19 to try to get that damn game going. And at the time I had been DJing, I had been working in clubs. I had built up a pretty decent following in the house music scene back in Chicago in the 80s. And I was given thought to actually opening up my own nightclub. And I was 19 at the time. And so I knew it would have to be a non-alcoholic club. But where I was thinking about opening up this club, it didn't, you know, there really weren't that many options for those who were 18 and under to go out and have a good time somewhere. And I knew that all the bars had to close at 1:30. And if we didn't serve booze, we could stay open, you know, as late as we wanted, right? So the idea was basically open up a dance club that would cater to teenagers 18 and under, you know, from 8 until 11:30 or so. And then we would close down and we would clean up and we would reopen around midnight and cater to those 18 and over from midnight until 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And of course, you know, by the time the bars closed, they had enough liquor in them. They were good to go. You know, then maybe they just come out and hang out. So the idea I thought it held merit. And so I had talked to my golf coach, who's also kind of a mentor of mine at the time. And I was telling him about the idea. And he was basically like, you know, look, what are you afraid of? You know, I mean, I think it sounds like a good idea. What are you afraid of? And I said, I don't know. I guess I'm afraid that it won't work. I'm afraid that I'll lose money. I'm afraid I'll look bad. I'm afraid I won't be able to recover. I, you know, I don't know what I'll be able to do after that if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't go to plan, which of course is pretty funny in hindsight, because how far could you really fall as an 18, 19 year old? But, you know, talk about relevance. What he said to me is something that I remember to this day, and I've almost used as a mantra, if you will, moving forward. And what he said to me was, look, man, I really do think it's a good idea. I think that you could do really, really well with it. And just tell me right now what it is that you're doing for money. And I told him, you know, I'm DJing in clubs, I'm pumping gas, I'm waiting tables, you know, I'm doing whatever I got to do here to make ends meet. And he said, yeah. And if things don't work out with the club, you can always go back to pumping gas. And it was just
until
like
the robots take over, but yeah.
Until the robots take over, which still hasn't happened. Yeah. But, you know, it was one of those lines that has literally lived with me for the better part of 30 years.
How did, let's finish the, take me to the end of the movie. How did this new club do?
So the club was called the Funky Pickle. And we actually opened the club. I wrote a business plan. I raised all of $25,000 for it, and ended up opening up the club. And it did.
It's so funny to see the smile in your face when you say Funky Pickle.
The Funky Pickle, dude.
This place.
Yeah. And it worked out really, really well for the first 18 months or so. And then, like any club run by a 19, 20 year old, 21 year old at that time,
fucked it up.
But, you know, relevance, as I said, is a relative term, you know?
I wish on everyone that they A, start a business early, and B, that that business is a complete fuck up, that it has success and then fucks up. That's exactly what happened to me. It's great to get humbled early. It's a set of learnings that you can't get any other way. I love that story. That's great, Steve.
Yeah, man. And so again, prominence to relevance. You know, whatever prominence means for you, whatever relevance means for you, that's really all that matters.
Yeah, but of course, look, I don't want to over tilt my comment. We all need to feel like we matter. We have to be relevant to somebody or someone. And I also think sort of maybe a little bit of the flip side of what I said earlier, that I think it may be a little bit different for women. I'm not sure. I'm not a gal, so I don't know. But what I observe strongly with men is, if a guy who is, you know, plus or minus 40-ish, is, in his own opinion, if he hasn't achieved some level of what he would consider success, if he doesn't think that he's a reasonably good provider, if he doesn't think that he's somebody who, for the most part, is good to his word or commitments, and in the domain of work, if he doesn't feel like he is generally respected by people for what he does and how he does it and his peers, in whatever field it is, the field matters a lot less, I think. But if those sorts of things aren't true, the guy's kind of fucked in the head. He's not settled, right? Because there's something about being a guy that means that self-actualization centers around some of those topics, I think.
Yeah.
And if you're still thrashing around in your 40s and you don't feel like you've gotten some of that to that kind of a place in your own mind about yourself, you've really robbed yourself of something. That's what I've noticed. The guys who are like that, there's something wrong for them about them. Do you know what I'm talking about, Steve?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're most men, not all, but most men, you know, we're raised playing games. You know, I mean, so most boys play games, and games have winners and games have losers. And from a young age, you know, we're wired to win. And very few of us are going to get to the point where we're going to get, you know, any sort of athletic thing going as a means with which to keep score. So, you know, there's only so many LeBron James and, you know, and football players and, you know, I mean, you name it, right? So there's only so many of those. So for the rest of us mere mortals, the way that we win, the way that we keep score is wholeheartedly designed around what it is that we're able to create in our lives, both for ourselves, of course, and then for those who decided to go on this journey with us. And so, you know, if our point total, if you will, is not where we want it to be, I mean, look, you can look at a guy like Bourdain. You know, I mean, my wife and I, his death hit my wife really, really hard. And she was a big fan of Robin Williams, a big fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, you know, and Anthony Bourdain's death actually hit her the hardest of the celebrity type people who have died in recent years. Because, you know, more so than almost anyone else, you know, you look at him and he just had this dream thing going. I mean, fuck, who doesn't want to be Anthony Bourdain? You know, traveling the world, hanging out with cool as shit people, eating amazing food and getting paid to do all of this and writing books and talking about his adventures. I mean, just on paper, it looks so good. And
he was the Bear Grylls of food.
Right.
I didn't really know him. You know what I mean? I knew his name and I didn't consume any of his stuff. I'm not a foodie. Mm-hmm. I live with foodies, which is amazing.
Yeah, I bet.
But I had a sense of him, and because that everything you said about him, as somebody who didn't really know him other than sort of by reputation, and that he'd created his own niche, and that's who, like, I knew that's who he was, but that's it.
Yeah.
But even for me, it was surprising. It's like, what? This guy has everything. What is going on?
Yeah. And so, you know, as it relates back then to his scorecard, something was missing, right? And that's where,
you know, I wonder about that though. I hate to interrupt you, Steve, but I don't know. Obviously, I don't know anything about him. I wonder, as somebody who's got some bipolar in me and can have very high highs and very low lows, you know, I wonder, was it something along those lines, you know, that if you, because I know for myself, when I'm in a very low low, like it's a giant, like shit gets black.
Oh yeah.
And you have to learn skills over your life to be able to stick handle out of those black corners. If you're somebody who's just wired that way, and to have people around you who love you and support you and all of that. And I don't think I'm that all that bad, but you know, it can get black.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, was it that, you know, did he have high highs and low lows? I have no idea. And it would be hard to believe that at a, let's call it a mid-level of psychic happiness, you know, not high, not low, but just that, or with some level of personal objectivity, be hard to believe that he had an impression of himself as somebody who was a failure or somebody who wasn't having a great life. But yeah. Who knows? You know, you don't know anything about somebody's real inner life. Who knows?
Yeah. Although I will say that, I mean, having been there as well, I mean, like I said, I mean, I, for a long time, I battled with exactly what you described. And in November 2013, you know, I will be the first to admit that I'm a coward. You know, if I was a strong person, and people can look at suicide however they want to look at it. Personally, I look at it from the standpoint of it takes an unbelievable amount of strength to look God in the eye and go, fuck you. You know, I'm going out on my terms. And so, you know, people can say it's a sign of weakness. They can say whatever they want. I actually think quite the contrary. I think that it takes an unbelievable amount of strength to be able to say, I'm going out on my own terms. And so, you know, look, reality is, having been in that place where I wasn't strong enough to do something to myself, but I might have driven the car straight when I should have turned, kind of thing, like just not turn the wheel. Like that would be my coward's way out, like just not turning the wheel around a bend kind of thing. But to do what he did, obviously he was in an incredibly dark place. But I do think before we start knocking this, that, and the other, and I'm not saying you are, you know, I think that we have to.
I'm not knocking anything.
Yeah. No, I know you're not.
All I'm saying is, from a third party perspective, he looked like he was having an amazing life.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, you never know what's going on in somebody else's life and somebody else's head. I'm not being.
Yeah.
I'm the last thing I would ever want to be is judgmental.
Yeah.
I don't have a negative opinion of people who commit suicide. Look, we're given the life that we have, and if we choose to take it, we choose to take it.
What I will say on that though is I do think that something on the scorecard was missing, right? And that's really more than anything else, whether it's in our 30s or 40s or wherever it is. You talked about, you know, people in their 40s with that scorecard of feeling like, hey, I should have been doing X, Y, or Z by now. I mean, you know, look, I'd love to be. I just had this conversation with my wife the other day. I'd love to be full on retired. You know, where like I don't have to work, and like I'm not at that place yet. Do I have a lot? Yes. Do I have enough? I don't think so, you know, because I know what it takes in order to live another 50 years, which is hopefully what I'm, you know, what I'm going to be looking at. But the point being, there was something missing on the scorecard, you know, whatever that was. It may have been a relationship. We don't know.
It's just hard to know.
But that's where
I look at the deaths and the suicides in rock and roll. You know, with Chris Cornell killing himself and then Chester Bennington killing himself, you know, a month later or 2 months later. Those are terrifying, absolutely terrifying things.
Yeah.
You
because
know, you look at it and you go, how could those guys, I mean, you're Chester Bennington, you're Chris Cornell. In my opinion, Chris Cornell had the best voice in hard rock.
Yeah.
You know, and how could you have had a more magical life as an artist? But you just don't know what's going on in somebody else's life.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And And again, I just know from being where I have been and talking to other people who have been in those dark places that it is usually the reflection of using, you know, the term that we've been talking about here. There is a deficiency on the scorecard somewhere. And that's why the want versus need conversation is so important, because we have to figure that out in order to, because again, the want part is going to drive you to that dark place. The need part,
I wonder if it's, maybe it's scorecard for some people. There's got to be a level of despair that is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a level of hopelessness that's extraordinary.
For sure. You know, there's
about something. I don't know what the something is, but
yeah,
life itself. I don't know. What I do know is if you have practiced the ability to design your life and you've been able to execute that design, and you're surrounded by good, healthy people, at least for me, those things make a giant difference. Let me say it that way, a giant difference in the dark periods for me.
You know, and it's interesting. And I will say this, which is, you know, a lot of the work that I do around the What Is Your What framework and helping people really discover their core gift, the primary vehicle they'll use to share that gift, and then the people they're most compelled to serve. You know, it is really interesting, and having worked now with thousands of people over the years, to see that if you can really sink your teeth into just one thing, it truly can last you a lifetime. I mean, it truly can be what puts that fire in your soul to get you to jump out of bed every single day. And, you know, there are a lot of people who end up pursuing whatever that is that they believe that they have to pursue, like a Cornell, right? I mean, with that amazing voice, how many times was he told that he had the most amazing voice? And how many times did he push himself into a corner where it's like, okay, what else am I going to do? And if he lost that love for doing the one thing that he's been told he is meant and made to do, what the fuck other options are there?
I don't know. Well, Steve, this has been a riveting conversation.
Thanks for ending on an I know, boys.
No, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Conversations are how they should be. So yeah. I think it's very illuminating. And I love how your wife's life calling or new life calling has clearly entered into so much of your thinking and your work. I think it's very cool. Yeah. Anything else before we kick out of this one, Steve?
I mean, I'll simply say this, that in whatever form or fashion, I wholeheartedly believe that you are the solution to someone else's problem. And those people are absolutely waiting and praying for you to show up in their lives. And, you know, who knows what conversation would have made all the difference in Cornell's life or in Bourdain's life or in your life, right? And ultimately, you just have to be willing to have more conversations and be willing to be the creator and allow yourself to be criticized, because at the end of the day, those folks are out there literally waiting for you. And the world is, you know, can be a very dark place for far too many. And I think it's our job to share as much of the light as we possibly can.
Well, that's kind of you to say, Steve. I really appreciate it. I don't even know how to, I'm not sure I know words to describe, you know, but this whole Legends and Losers experience has just been amazing. I get to have conversations that there's no way I would have had otherwise. It's very nice that you say what you said. So thank you. I deeply appreciate it. And look, here's what I believe, because it's been true for me. It may sound corny or like a throwaway line, but it's true. One conversation can change your life. And really, it's one of the few things. I think experiences can change your life too, but there are a few things that can truly move you, and a conversation can move you. You know, and I think one of the things that we've lost, or lost maybe too overly dramatic, but certainly one of the things that we're losing, is the ability to sit down with each other, look at each other in the eye, and have a conversation about something of value. And sure, maybe chase zebras down rabbit holes and have fun, and we don't always have to be serious and all that. But human beings need to look each other in the eye and have conversations about things that are important to them. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So thank you. And thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to spend some more time with you.
Yeah, man.
All right, brother.
All right, my friend.
Legendary.
You also.
Whew. I hope you love that episode. I hope you love every episode. And I want you to know that the best way you can say thank you is to share Legends and Losers. Make no mistake, you telling your friends, you sharing on social media is the main driver of our podcast. And it means the world to all of us at Legends and Losers. Obviously, to me, when you share Legends and Losers on social media and with your friends. Now, is it grow time for your business? Go to netsuite.com/legends, and there our friends at NetSuite will set up for you a free 1-hour growth review to talk to an expert in your industry about how to overcome the challenges and capitalize on opportunities for you to grow, improve your growth by moving your business to the cloud. In a recent study by SL Associates, they found that NetSuite customers reported stunning improvements in key performance metrics after switching to NetSuite. NetSuite is a complete business management system in the cloud. And companies that switch to NetSuite, for example, often experience a 10% increase in revenue, an 80% increase in business insights, a 5% increase in gross margins. That all sounds pretty great, right? We do know there's a huge advantage for companies who run their business in the cloud. Make no mistake, when you move to NetSuite, you're tapping into the power of Oracle. And what I love about NetSuite and so many of the new technologies today is they are leveling the playing field for growth companies, for small entrepreneurs to design and dominate their categories and to beat the snot out of the bad guys. So check out netsuite.com/legends to turbocharge your growth today. All right. We would like to thank our friend Steve Oshler. He's awesome. Check out Beyond Eight Figures, his new podcast. It's fantastic. Equity Directory, the invite-only network of entrepreneurs and startup talent exchanging work for equity. The awesome nonprofit that I've been involved with from the very beginning. Check out onelifefullylived.org, where we, for as close to free as possible, help you dream, plan, and live your best life. And if you're an accomplished person and you want to help other people become accomplished, we are always looking for donors. So check out onelifefullylived.org, and make no mistake, you can consume our material, but we want your money. Now, if you are in marketing, or you're an event planner and you're looking for legendary keynote speakers, one of the most inspiring people I know is Will Little. He's been on the podcast multiple times. And when Will Little is speaking or reading a poem, nobody is on their smartphone. Check out Will, the letter V, like victory, little.com. Our good friends at Bixen 2, Joe and Bix Bixen, helping executives hack the future. Check out Bixen2.com. For sales leaders who want to make money and salespeople who like to be more successful, my favorite sales app, check out Spiro, Spiro.ai. And the new place for thought leadership for entrepreneurs on the interweb, check out growwire.com. I blog there on a regular basis, and there's lots of information. There's lots of great content. There's a podcast. There's a TV show. There's lots of cool shit. Check out growwire.com. And please don't forget the amazing people at Habitat for Humanity. Habitat's vision is of a world where everyone has a decent place to live. If you want to make a difference, check out habitat.org. All right, I need to remind you that today's information is provided to you solely for information, and all episodes of Legends and Losers are produced in a studio that does contain nuts. This oddcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Oddcast Network, and man, oh man, I would love it if you shared the shit out of it right now. Please do not eat food with ingredients you can't pronounce. Don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Support your local category designer. Never forget, there's no such thing as a participation award. Thank you, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go to Oscar Munoz. CEO of United Airlines. Sorry, Oscar, we just ran out of time for you. That's it. Thank you so much for investing part of your life with us. And I look forward to seeing you again soon on Legends and Losers.